This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
We won't take questions then. We'll let the other speakers speak. Then we'll sit in the plenary and you can ask questions of either speaker. Does that sound okay? So that you give the opportunity. What we think is that it will be about 20 minutes for each speaker and plenty of time for discussion at the end. This is the first event that we've done of this kind. It's run by the Equality and Diversity Unit. Kirsten Cooper, who's here, has overseen it. Hopefully it will be one of many on different topics that are significant for equality and diversity. It originated because Amadei got in touch with us and asked if he could speak, and then the Islamic Society asked if there could be a second speaker, and it's fitted well for everyone. So that's the way it's going to go. If there is an alarm, a fire alarm, it's not a practice. We would be told if there was a practice. So if there is, please go out in an orderly fashion there, and if you would, then go onto the grass. I hope you will enjoy the evening. As you can see, it is going to be filmed, and I look forward to some really interesting and very, very relevant information. So, over to you first.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this study was done in Britain and America amongst 400 or 500 lay Muslims in the two countries who were asked whether they thought that Islam and Oxford were compatible. The reason for that was because I'm just saying that this was a study done with lay Muslims living in Britain and America to ask them what they thought about the compatibility of Islam and democracy. And the reason for that was that Samuel Huntington, a professor from Harvard, had said that there is an inherent clash of civilization between Islam and the West. Probably all know that. And we wanted to find out whether he was right. And we decided that the clash would be between Islam and not Christianity, but democracy. Democracy probably being the most important principle of the West. So we ran the thing, and I'll tell you more about it in a minute. I've had about 100 meetings like this in the two countries, putting forward the results, I must say, I went recently, just at the end of last year, to the Southern States in the U.S., and was surprised to find that the relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims had deteriorated substantially since my previous visit. And I think that the reason was because of the suggestion of having a mosque in Manhattan close to Grand Zero. And I think Obama got it exactly right. He said, of course, you have the right to have a mosque there, but he didn't want it. And I think the two sides have got themselves entrenched and it's doing harm. So that's the present position of how I see in the United States between Muslims and the rest of the population. In Europe, on the continent of Europe, things got very, very much worse. This is a French minister, we believe in multiculturalism. The French minister in charge of home affairs said multiculturalism is nonsense, and he referred to London, bit longer than it started. And he said, we will not have Baghdad on the stage, or any nonsense like that. And the Chancellor of Germany, Mrs. Merkel, said, Germany is not a multicultural country. 4 million Turks live in Germany, and the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, was there recently, and he spoke to 11,000 of them in a meeting in. Can you hear me, Matt? Good. He spoke to 11,000 of them in a meeting in Dusseldorf, and he said, you should learn, he's talking about the children, you should learn Turkish first. And Mrs. Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, immediately replied that no children should learn German first. And there wasn't a very good relationship between the Prime Minister of Turkey and the Chancellor of Germany. A social democrat politician called Sarah Zahn wrote a book recently in October, it was published. 1 million copies were sold within a month, and it's extremely anti-Muslim. It says, Muslims are un-German and undesirable. At the same time, a poll was held in Germany, and 17% of the population said they would support a new anti-Muslim party in Germany if it existed. And then in France and Spain, Italy and Holland and Belgium and Norway, they, and of course Switzerland, they had laws passed or being passed against wearing the niqab in public. And so you can see that things got very much worse in the last, say, 6 months. Short as that, or say, anyway, the last year, both in America and on the continent of Europe, but not happening in Britain. Then on the 17th of January, everything changed because of the crises in Tunisia and Egypt and other countries. 150 or more million Arabs in fact have risen up against their despotic rulers. And for now, in fact even still now, there are no democracies amongst Arab countries at all. All the Muslim democracies are Turkey, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Pakistan. And so the Arabs have not got a democratic country to look to or to follow at all. And until very recently, it was thought about something different about Arabs. They were, for some reason, not appropriate for democracy. And now, of course, we've had mass demonstrations calling for democracy in Cairo and in Tunisia, and of course also votes in Yemen and Bahrain and Syria. Though whether they were calling for democracy is not quite clear. But there's no doubt at all that in Egypt and in Tunisia, these enormous crowds are calling for democracy. That's on one side. On the other side, at the very same time these meetings, these mass demonstrations taking part, 90 Muslim preachers from all over the world met, and they called for justice and freedom, but opposed democracy, which might lead to un-Islamic practices. And they said people would only have shura as a consultation, not democracy. On the other hand, Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, a leader of the AKP party in Turkey, it's an Islamic party, and there's always been some doubt as to what his real intentions are. He once said, democracy is like a train from which you alight when you reach your destination. He was quite young when he said that. But I met somebody in Washington who knows him quite well and said they'd often discuss what this meant, what was the destination he was speaking of. And he said the destination is Islam. In other words, you can give up democracy when you reach Islam and perfection. But however you interpret what he said there, there has always been a doubt hanging over as to what he really means to do in Turkey, whether he really defends democracy or not. Because the Turks now are divided races, strictly between Islamists and the secular army people and civil servants and others. And they don't trust him in the least.
Oh, okay, could you just stop for a minute? We'll just talk that until the music goes off.
Till the what?
If someone's got their mobile on. I should have said it at the beginning, actually, to turn your mobile on. Please turn your mobiles off.
So long as they don't explode.
Okay, go on then.
But now, with all the demonstrations in Cairo and Tunisia, Erdogan has come out absolutely firmly on the side of democracy and can never be suggested again that he does not support democracy. He said in the context in Istanbul about the Cairo riots, Turkey shows that Islam and democracy can coexist. From this moment on, Egypt must hold fair and free elections to form a constitutional democracy. So there's no doubt at all now, we can safely say that he is a genuine democrat, and then we can look to the future of Turkey as a democratic country in the long term as well as the short term. On the other hand, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who 20 years ago democracy was absolutely was they called an apostasy, but they actually took over the demonstrations in Cairo after the first 2 or 3 days from all the young people who were calling for democracy. The Muslim Brotherhood took it over and led, and they are now really the strongest political force in Egypt. And no doubt will play a big part in elections that will take place in September. And their leader said, Muslim Brotherhood is against a religious state, and it's a state run by a religious leader like Iraq. But a civil state is what they want, with religious reference. So that's what he said. It's not really quite clear, and maybe he himself doesn't know what the Muslim Brotherhood will go for eventually, because there are different generations and they have different attitudes, and they've been suppressed for the last 20 or 30 years, so it would be very difficult to hold meetings and have debates and so on. And now they can start talking to each other in public and making up their mind. But there's always been doubt as to what the real intentions of them. Muslim Brotherhood are with regard to democracy. If we look back, of course, 20 years ago, it was apostasy for them. On the other hand, in Tunisia, the Islamic party there, whose leader in exile in London for the past 20 years has just gone back, he said to them, Gerouchi, he said, we are closer to the AKP, that's the Erdogan's party in Turkey, than the Muslim Brotherhood. So as far as the Islamists are concerned in Tunisia, they are for democracy as much as Turkey is. In this study, we chose to invite only lay Muslims in, not academics or clerics, because we were well aware that some academics and clerics in the Muslim world who are against democracy on principle. And so these were perfectly ordinary British and American Muslims. We also realized that if the views of the academics who are against democracy were widely accepted, this would show up in the results of the study. We had 38 groups of lay Muslims, 400 or 500 of them in all, spread right across America and Britain. They were completely haphazardly chosen, but not by any scientific means at all. They each group of about a dozen held three meetings, each lasting 2.5 hours. So they had a really good, long discussion. Each group had 7.5 hours to talk amongst themselves on Islam and democracy. And they wrote down everything they wanted to write down. They were businessmen and engineers and school teachers and professionals and their spouses and students. The students often were in a different, separate meeting of their own, not always. All their views were recorded anonymously because, particularly in America, they were worried about the security authorities and their names being reported to the authorities. And so in both countries, they were all totally anonymous. I don't know the names of any of the people who took part. In fact, I met very few of them, because they were scattered right across from San Diego in America to Southern England. And I didn't attend any officially. I went to one or two to see how things were. And so nobody knows who these Muslims were. They were absolutely anonymous and haphazard selection of people. Each one was asked to speak for him or herself and not to try to come to a common agreement amongst the lot. And so all the things they wrote down were for each one thought. And of course, their views obviously developed as the meetings went by. And so when you read the whole lot, you can, on the United Nations website, there was a report of every single thing that they wrote down. Every single thing is there. You get a very good idea of what their views were. They were asked to ignore the peculiarities of British and American democracy. Our system is peculiar. We have two parties. I hope there are no liberals here. Generally speaking, we have two parties. So there's a liberal. they fight against each other, one in, one out. It's red in tooth and claw, and violence swings from one side to the other, exaggerating far beyond what the vote it actually did. It's almost a caricature of parliamentary democracy that these two countries had. But generally speaking, I think the voters in both countries accept it. They trust the system. If they lose this election, they'll win the next one. And so they don't really put up with being out of the government. They don't mind, but they know they'll probably win the election after this one. And in both countries, that is the case. Everybody accepts the fact it's a very rough and ready system. And as I say, red in tooth and claw. I may be proved wrong when we have a referendum and everybody's asked, do they want to have the alternative vote? Because the alternative vote would get rid of the system. It would mean that, generally speaking, I don't know, I think one will always have a government of the middle. Presumably the Liberals will be in each government, and it would be either Labour or Conservative with them. And so we have a consistent government, whatever party is in power. But if we find the referendum is not voted in, and it's not they don't vote for the alternative vote system, we'll go on with our rough and ready system we have now, which, I say, gives strong governments, but not really any accurate representation of the views of the people. Now, on the continent of Europe, on the other hand, because of the traumas of the war and the occupations and so on that they suffered, they want a quiet life, and they want gentle readjustments between the parties each election. Each election, a few seats change. You normally have coalitions of two or three different parties because no one's got a majority, and therefore the government, the leadership is weak because it is a coalition, it's safe. It basically, of course, it's the same as in Britain and America, one person, one vote, and so on, but they're going for a safe system because they generally begin proportional representation, which means to have a pretty steady support of each party after one election after another. So the Muslims in this study were asked to consider democracy simply to be this: one person, one vote, secret ballot, the government to follow the views of the majority, protection of minorities. And the last thing is because in most countries outside Europe, there are substantial minorities, either ethnic or religious, who will probably never be the government and never have a majority, and they do need a guaranteed rights for themselves, which hasn't been the case in Europe. So those were the characteristics of democracy those they were asked to discuss. They were asked to exclude one person, one vote, one time, no elections. That means you have an election where one party says, if I am elected, I will abolish the parliament and abolish democracy. That, of course, is democracy, because if the people vote for that, that was a democratic position. But these Muslims were asked not to consider that to democracy, because it would be so easy to say, yes, I approve of democracy, because in fact, when we have an election, I shall vote for the party which says it will abolish democracy. And so that was excluded. Now the results of all these meetings were that the Muslim taking part did not really give any thought at all to existing Muslim democracies, Turkey, Pakistan, Malaysia, and Indonesia. They seemed to be considering a notional Muslim country which was democratic. In other words, sort of ideal Muslim country which is democratic. The results of what they said were exactly the same in both Britain and America. And in fact, one of the results has come out from Italy in the last couple of months and shows the same there. The things they say are indistinguishable from meeting to meeting. You can't tell if you read a report of, say, Northeast London. It's from Northeast London. It sounds exactly like Chicago. It's an extraordinary thing that I've never been able to identify where a statement comes from, simply by the statement itself, until I look at it and says where the meeting took place. Of course, there's no name of the person because they're anonymous, but where the meeting took place is always recorded. Their views were really indistinguishable, that's the first thing. The second thing is that they were in a quite narrow band of opinion. They said everything. If lots of said democracy is bad and lots of it was good and everything in between, you'd have said, well, there's no conclusion from this study. Whereas in fact, all four or 500 of them said the same thing within a narrow ambit. They really didn't know each other, they had no contact with each other, and they lived thousands of miles apart in many cases. And I think the results are significant. What they said was this. First of all, Islam is the only principle or ideal. And as one said, it is drawn down from heaven. And the democracy, on the other hand, is man-made, evolving and imperfect and pragmatic, could be good, could be bad. A professor in Westminster University, when I said this, said, yes, democracy is a technology. It's a way of doing things. It's not a principle or an ideal. It's just a technology amongst many others. And that has come down to the view of all these lay Muslims. They all said Islam is the only principle and ideal, and democracy is down here, and it's a mere way of doing things. And some thought it was the best there was, and some didn't think it was so good. And therefore, there was no clash between Islam and democracy in their mind, because they never met. Islam's up there, and democracy's down here. And so none of them thought there was a clash between Islam and democracy. Westerners, non-Muslim Westerners, I think generally consider democracy to be an ideal and a principle and a global concept. But these Muslims did not think it was an ideal or a principle, but merely technology And they did nothing, I didn't mention before, they did nothing, it was a global concept. It was just one way of doing things. And so those were their views. And what was left aside was really how good they think Moxie was as a way of doing government. And I think the most favorable result was what Winston Churchill once said, democracy is a bad form of government, but all the others are worse. Some of them did think it was the best form of existed, and some thought it was not good. The students in inner London, I say inner London to exclude you, said that democracy was bad because, not in principle, but simply because the Parliament in Westminster didn't follow the views of the people, and that is, they watched the demonstrations against war, and the Parliament was happily going on as if these demonstrations would exist, and therefore these students in East London said democracy was bad because it didn't work, because the MPs didn't represent the people. But there was one vital proviso that they all made, in addition to all I've said so far. They said, nothing contrary to the Quran shall happen in a Muslim democracy. Now, of course, when you come to think that's an obvious thing to say. The Quran is a book that explains all things, and nothing is omitted from the book. And so they're absolutely right in saying that nothing contrary to the Quran should happen in a Muslim democracy. As an ex-parliamentarian, I've been thinking about what is the consequence of this limitation on democracy, that nothing contrary to the Quran shall happen in a Muslim democracy. And looking at it from a pragmatic point of view, there are quite a large number of instructions in the Quran as to what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Food laws, gambling, usury, apostasy, miserliness, and a few others. But none of those have punishments on earth in the Quran. They're only punished in hell. And therefore, so far as a parliament is concerned, they can pass what laws they like about punishments for food laws and apostasy and usury, or not as they wish. Because the Quran merely has the punishment in hell. The only wrong deeds which have punishments attached to them, in fact, are adultery, which is 100 strokes, but not stoning, because there's no stoning in the Quran. Theft, which has cutting the hand unless the thief repents. Thing that people seem to forget very often, that in the Quran that limitation is put on it. False accusation, fornication, lewdness amongst men, and fighting Muhammad in his war against the Meccans when he was in Medina. Those are the only acts in the Quran which have a punishment attached to them, which takes place in this life. And so a parliament is free to do what it likes about criminal law in choosing punishments. It can't say, of course, that apostasy is not a crime, but it can decide what the punishment should be, because that is not set out in the Quran. There are, of course, in the Quran inequalities for women, which everybody knows about, the value of their witness in commercial cases, divorce, and inheritance, and rights over children, and dress. All it says about dress is dress shall be modest. The scarf come down to the neckline, that's all it says. It also says men should be modest in their dress as well, so nothing unfair about that. These limitations may be considered by many people in the 21st century to be serious, and they are to a degree, but you could hardly say that these limitations condemn Islam not to be able to run democracy effectively. And so my conclusion is senator and next legislator, that the limitation that all these people put on their acceptance of Boxer, that nothing contrary to the Quran can happen, is not an exception, which would be an embarrassment for Parliament. And I just want to make very quickly by saying that, and I put this straight to Turkey too. Turkey has the AKP party, which is Islamic, and it has a number of secular parties. The Islamic party is in power now. In the long run, it may be that it would be better if Turkey had coalitions rather than just the AKP in power. Undoubtedly, for all other Muslim democracies, I'm quite sure that coalitions are essential, because unlike in Britain and America, because in Britain and America, the winner takes all, and the elections go back and forth between the two parties. It's inaccurate and slapdash, but it's accepted by the people for a long time. But it would be a disaster to try and impose, try and adopt that kind of democracy, where you have one party in power and one out, in and out, in a Muslim country. Because they all have substantial minorities, either religious or ethnic, who would never be in power, and therefore the in-out, they would never be in. And with coalitions, coalition governments, then all parties are in the government, and they all take part in government, and everybody feels the government belongs to them. Not only that, which means it would work in a sense, but not in that. The idea of coalition, I think, is really cardinal to the Quran itself, because a coalition is consultation, conciliation, and community, and that's exactly what the Quran lays most stress on, those three characteristics. And therefore, I believe that a Muslim country which adopts democracy should do so not in the least following Britain or America or their inner system, but following a much more gentle kind of democracy where you have coalitions of all interests in government all the time.
Thank you very much for that. Andre is a Queen's Counsel, he's been an MEP, and Sally, he was talking about is Muslim grassroots influence discuss the democracy. So it's a large scale study, and I'm sure that we would find that very interesting given that European perspective. We didn't just see it in there, so it's absolutely what's happening there. And next speaker, Abdullah Al-Dawoodi, the son of Al-Dawoodi, has studied Islam in depth since 2018. He's worked for 13 years in the local Muslim community and internationally, and he has written many studies looking particularly at discussions of Islam creating activism. And we look forward to your talk.
Basically, I think there's democracy is a very popular term at this point in time in the world history. Everyone uses it, everyone wants to use it, everyone wants to label themselves by democracy. You know, George Orwell wrote about a particular word, democracy, very interestingly. He said that everyone calls their country democratic. It's viewed as a term of praise. So a fascist would call their country democratic, a communist would call their country democratic, a liberal or a liberalist would call their country democratic. Everyone wants to use this term because it's in vogue. And the problem is, he says, that no one knows what it actually means. Its definition, there's no fixed definition. You know, you could put a few Democrats in a room, five Democrats in a room to discuss with democracy, and you come up with 10 opinions. So this is the problem with understanding what is democracy and how can we even discuss a clash of civilizations between a term which is not defined and the Islamic civilization? So I would say that perhaps better the discussion would be maybe liberalism and Islam, is there a clash of civilizations? As you can see in the West, there is something which is of a higher value than democracy, which no one can override, and that is liberal values, liberalism, human rights, these things all come under the rubric of liberalism or libertarianism, whatever word it goes under. And you can't vote out human rights, in theory, anyway. You can't vote out human rights, you can't vote out people's freedoms or liberty itself. You just can't vote it out. So democracy in these countries has limitations. And these limits are fixed. You can't change it. No matter if 90%, in theory anyway, if 90% voted against this, they would say, sorry, your views don't count. You must comply with democracy. Example, BNP. They wanted to join this democratic system with their ideas. But they were told that in order to be a legal party, you must accept multiracial policy for induction. And of course, for them, they've always been very much on the kind of racial side of things, racial discriminatory, and so on. So for them now to be compelled to actually adopt liberal values before they can even walk through the door, so to speak, of being a considered political party, tells you something about the West. Now, I think when Muslims, when we use the word democracy, again, I think a lot of Muslims, we don't understand fully what that word means, and a lot of Muslims don't understand what that word means. But when we use it, I guess it's in a similar manner. It's a very similar manner. But we have a higher ideal. This higher ideal is Islam or Sharia. In the West, the higher ideal is liberalism. In China, it's, in theory, communism. And underneath that, these ideologies, which can't be changed, are in theory, immutable. Within this, then you can have different parties, plural different parties. I mean, you can't vote out the American Constitution. And do you know why the American Constitution exists? It's because the American founding fathers couldn't trust the American people, or any people, to actually maintain human rights of minorities and so on. They had to institute the Constitution because they were scared of the tyranny of the majority. So that was itself a limitation on democracy, because democracy is too fickle. What happened in Weimar Republic Germany, which is pre-World War II? What happened? They voted in the Nazi Party. This is considered to be a bit of a danger in the West. You can't have anyone deciding, any group of people deciding any party on whim, because bad things can happen, and they usually have. But before I go into this, what do we have in common? Before I go into more deep discussion, I think that as Muslims, as people who have undergone the Enlightenment, if you could say, we have a lot of things in common. For example, we all believe in freedom from arbitrary rule. We all believe this. We all believe in freedom from the subjugation to the vanity of others. We believe in the freedom to choose our beliefs and practice them, i.e. coexistence and tolerance. And we also believe in fostering an environment to achieve the holistic and consistent fulfillment of human nature. Our conceptions of human nature differ, but we at least believe that we should foster an environment to establish. So this is our common, we all agree on this. But now the nitty gritty is, well, what is this, and what is justice, and what is equality, and what is distributed justice, and how do you define these terms? Well, this is the difference of opinion. Some people say that because the Quran says discharge your affairs by mutual consultation, this refers to democracy. But, as in, the ruler must consult the people, and this is democracy. Maybe, if you consider that to be a definition. However, the term is discharge your affairs, not decide your affairs. So the people don't decide what the particular legislation that the government produces in an Islamic state. However, they are consulted with the implementation of policy, because the people know better than anyone else what is practically possible. And a government or academic knows what's theoretically possible. So how does the academic or the government meet the people is through consultation to discuss these things. Now, I'd say that the basis of the Islamic system is mentioned in Surah 6, verse 157, which says, "He will enjoin upon them which are right and wrong, and forbid them which is wrong. He will make lawful for them all the good things, and prohibit for them all the bad things. And he will relieve them of the burden and the fetters they used to wear." So it's referring to God is giving us a prescription for things which will be good, and avoiding us to avoid things which are bad. And this will liberate us from the kind of subjugation that we were under before, either subjugation to oligarchy, subjugation to tyrants, subjugation to majorities. Islam is meant to liberate, and how it liberates is by producing a law system which the majority or the minority can't overrule. No one can overrule it. It's been described, I think a better description for Islam, or the Sharia itself, or Sharia state, is a nomocracy. And if anyone knows Greek, a nomos means law, and kresi means power. So it is the law is sovereign, not people, not one dictator, not a majority or a minority. The law itself is the sovereign. And the interesting thing about Islam is that no one can own the law. It's not owned by a theocracy or a small elite group of clergy. It's not owned by one dictator who can dictate what is infallible and so on, according to their theology. No. Anyone and everyone can own the law, provided you have enough academic clout and you've studied it. Then it is essentially open source code for anyone that does computer science. It is Linux compared to Windows. Anyway. But first, I want you to understand why Europe adopts democracy. Because we have to understand this. Because as the Muslim civilization, the Islamic civilization, never went through the same historical experiences which made the Europeans adopt democracy. And what happened was, essentially, with the Greeks, they were under, let me see, a dictatorship. They the large insurrectionist dictatorship, overruled it, and then decided that, for practical purposes, for some reason, the people will rule instead of the dictator, because dictators are tyrannical. And it was just a pragmatic solution by the Greeks. And in some ways, it was very interesting how the Greeks did it. It's literally by random lot, anyone can be the ruler, which was quite interesting because you don't have that Athenian democracy in existence. That democracy of the Greeks no longer exists. Some might say, unfortunately. What Europe did during the Enlightenment era, in counting its obviously tyrannical kings and dictators and so on, they said to themselves, we need to find an alternative system, right? The church seemed to own the kind of religious law, the Catholic Church. So the people had no love there. That was a very close clique of an oligarchy, a very close clique of people. You had the kings who were saying, by divine right, we should rule, and you must obey us, whatever we say. And so people couldn't find any solace there. So they instead adopted democracy because of that experience. Whereas for Muslims, the Islamic civilization, we never went through that experience. So we never saw a need for democracy because our leaders were, by and large, accountable. And when you look at Islamic history, there are so many, actually, revolutions. People said, but if your Islamic history is so good, why are there so many revolutions and uprisings? And the reason being is because whenever a dictator got out of when a caliph became a dictator, the Muslims rose up against him. And everyone was armed. So they rose up against him to depose him, much like how the founding fathers allowed all Americans to possess weapons, so that no dictator can come back and dictate to the American people what they should be doing against their better judgment, reason, or conscience. So this is what Islam did. And we never went through that experience, so we never developed it. But, as I said, Islamic history is a different discussion. But that's the explanation of the different historical perspectives between, Islam and the West. We have to both understand this in order to understand each other. So we cannot project our own history onto the other person. We've had a problem with the church, we've had a problem with kings and so on, you guys need to adopt our system. I said, well, actually, we have had this problem until only very recently, post-colonization. And unfortunately, a lot of these governments haven't been instituted. Most of these governments have not been instituted in Muslim world by Muslims, but rather they were instituted by colonialists. And so this is a really interesting fact. I think the one thing they did give us is kings and dictators. And so it's like, well, we don't know what a king dictator looks like, we'll give you one. Then we'll decide to adopt democracy at that point in time. So, what is the Islamic contentions, I would say, with, what are the contentions with democracy? Where are the differences? I mentioned some similarities. Where are the differences? Well, the issue of sovereignty of the people, majoritarianism, procedural, proceduralism, or the procedural problems of democracy, and of course, the liberal justification. justification for democracy is an issue. Now, the sovereignty of the people issue, I think it's commonly known, as Amadeus studies did elicit, that Muslims generally believe that sovereignty belongs to God. The Quran is very explicit on this. Sovereignty is with God first, not with the people. However, the Quran says that we are mankind is a khalifa on earth. We are vicegerents. God has deputized us with authority to enact the law, to act with good conscience and in the right manner. So we might not have sovereignty, but we have deputized authority as human beings. So the Ummah, the people, possess the authority, and they select one from amongst them to institute the organization known as a state in order to manage resources and protect property. So the Khalifa is not an Islamic head of the Islamic polity, is not the sovereign, but he's the delegated authority from passed from the people, originally given to the people by God. So this is how the Islamic perspective works in it. But we don't call it sovereignty, we call it authority. Now, but I'll try and be very quickly as to where the contentions lie, and it's quite a very interesting discussion in and of itself. Essentially, one of the main aspects of a democracy is the majority will, or the majority rule, or the majority will out, or some majority of some kind, in almost every form of democracy which is currently espoused. Now, my contention, the contention of philosophers such as Hobbes and Plato, is that people generally don't know what is good for the group. They know what is good for themselves as individuals sometimes. Right. Now, even then, that's also a bit of an issue. But for the group, they can't possibly know. Why is that? Because as individuals, you are focused on your life, you're focused on your work, you're focused on your studies, your family, just getting by day to day. You don't have as much time as you as a member of parliament or the Prime Minister, President or King, to look into what's happening around the country, where the resources are needed, what the needs of the people, political philosophy, fiscal policy. Most of us are just not experts in any of those things. Not to mention the fact that we don't even know what's even happening fully in our country at any moment in time. The government knows more about what's happening than the journalists do, because the government gets intelligence from the normal channels, from councils, from hospitals, from what happened. It's just normal. So obviously, this is the case. So people don't know, and they call this rational ignorance. Essentially, rational ignorance is that people know that they don't have enough time. So what they do, they adopt a very simple criteria of how to judge, let's say, a good candidate from a bad candidate in an election. And then they just say, I like to go with him, looks younger. David Cameron looks younger. I'll go with him. Yeah, or they'll just say, I think, we do need to stop spending cuts. But when the spending cuts come, it's like, oh my God, they've done too many spending cuts. And it's like, so they don't know, so at any point in time, they have a very, very basic and simple criteria. So Plato says this is not a basic flow system. And what does the Quran say about this? In Surah 6, Ayah 116, if you obey the majority of people on earth, they diverge you from the path of God. They follow only conjecture. Another Surah, Al-Hujurat, Ayah 7, and know that other messengers among you, most of you. So if he was to follow most of you in the rule, then you would all surely fall into hardship. So the Prophet Muhammad is the Quran is saying that if the Prophet Muhammad even followed his companions in Mecca on the rule, just whatever they asked him for everything. Yeah, I think we have this law and that law. If he followed them, then they would all fall into hardship. You see, he said most of you. They said so. It's not, the Quran doesn't believe that majorities are correct. In fact, most people don't know what's beneficial for the group because we're just individuals and we only be leading our individual lives. So this is natural. Another problem: most people succumb to irrationality. So, as the Quran says, Allah would make this burden light for you, for man is created weak. So Allah gives the sharia because we are great, we. As in, we succumb to irrationality. We have the capacity for rational thought, but most of us, most of the time, are irrational. So if people have trouble following diets, they have trouble visiting advertisements, they follow fashion, they're told to shop even though it's beyond their means, and so on. They can't resist temptation to do these things, even when they know it's bad for them. So many people do this. it is a persistent problem. They have some of the self-help guides and hypnotism, you know, self-hypnosis, all these kind of things to get people to be rational, but they can't, because most people will act in an irrational manner. It's just human nature. It's nothing wrong. Islam doesn't condemn human beings for this, because Allah made us like this, that we have an irrational side to us. So what Islam tries to do is it makes it easy for human beings by removing these temptations away from us, so that we can act more rationally. And of course, by giving us an alternative way to fulfill ourselves, which will follow the more correct and progressive way. So, other issues that people are not always capable to investigate things. I already said this, but there's a verse of Quran, Surah 4, Ayat 83, that when it comes to them a matter touching public safety or fear, they make it known among the people. If only they had referred it to the messenger or to those charged with authority amongst them, the proper investigations would have been understood from them directly. So, the Quran is saying that people don't know how to react to issues. They react on a very superficial level, with kind of sometimes mass hysteria, telling everybody about it, and then there's rumors abound, and people act in a very chaotic manner. If only they had left it to those who were in a position to investigate issues to produce the correct understanding of what's happening at any given point in time. It's why we had governments in the first place. It's why we have the governments. It's because the government has acted to more intelligence, so to speak, on the ground than we do as individuals. So how can we now make people the basis for legislation or deciding what to do at any point in time? And I'm not the only one that says this. It's not the Quran that's the only one that says this. You have Edmund Burke, again, Plato, Hobbes, and a whole host of other political philosophers lauded and looked up to in the West, which have just said the same thing. It's not Islam saying this, it's most people saying this. Now, people are subject to group hysteria, peer pressure, ignorance, and prejudice. And from the earliest democracy in the Greek times, when you had after the Battle of, I think it's right, Argynnousae, when the Athenians won a better victory over the Spartans, and at some point mistakes were made, some generals let some people die accidentally or what have you, and the people were so incensed that they had public courts where you would be subject to the will of the people. These people, all generals, were executed. All the innocent ones included, they were all executed by the people because they were all angry at the generals failing to save some soldiers or something. And this very callous manner, this mass hysteria, mass prejudice, we've seen currently in Socrates, by the way, is also executed by the Athenians as well. They start to accuse him of corrupting the youth. There's mass hysteria. He was executed because the majority voted at the time. The Burqa ban in France, this great bastion, the great bastion of representative coalition of democracy. It represents, proportional representation, right? Why isn't it that in the countries that have more proportional representation than in England, America, you have more laws discriminating against minorities? Why is that? Because anyone who studies political philosophy yourselves will also see that what has been observed is that coalition governments tend to let the extremists out of the ban. Because the coalition is so weak that any of the old extremists only need a very small minority of people to get their wacky opinions passed. Whereas in a more Anglo-American system, there is more control. All parties are brought into the centre, so to speak. They're actually more moderated. And again, we can all thank Edmund Burke for this, for his foresight on this. But even then, there's problems with the Anglo-American system. But because I believe my colleague has issues as well with the Anglo-American system, I'll say actually has some advantages over the European system, which is just as chaotic in some time. Minaret ban in Switzerland, they start putting these posts up with like minarets, they count like missiles and Burqa, the woman in the Burqa in the front. Like that has anything to do with the voting in the first place, but minarets are not because of the Burqas. And Swiss just went nuts. Collective mass hysteria. There's a belief that Islam taking over the West from the inside. This has become a hysteria spreading. In America, one state, the people passed by referendum, they banned Sharia in that state, even though there was no Sharia in the state. Where is this? But just in case, they said, we're going to ban it. In case there was a Sharia come to our state and try to transform our government. Hysteria, and the Constitutional Court overrid it because it was deemed to be, obviously, an anti-minority. And so on. So this is the issue. Again, Israel has a look recently now has laws discriminating against Arabs. They banned the commemoration of the Nakba, which is the Palestinian community, I guess you could say, was time of mourning for when Israel was created and they were kicked out of their lands. Fine, Zionism, I don't like that. It should be in a free state, you should, you know, find someone to commemorate, it's fine. But no, the majority governments passed this law to ban and fine anyone who commemorates the Nakba amongst Arab organizations. And of course, many, many, many other examples. So these are issues with democracy which I think any rational person, not just Muslim or whatever, any rational person would see there's a problem with. And in Surah Al-Furqan, ayah 43-44, it says, have you not seen those who take as their God their own desires? Would you be a disposer of their affairs, of these people? Or do you think that most of them here understand they are only like cattle, nay, they are even further astray from the path? So the Quran is saying that people who just take any desires, willy-nilly, as their ultimate base in life, whatever they might be, the impulse, then they're going to be affected like a herd, so to speak, like a herd of animals will go in one direction or another direction, what have you. They can be led around. And this is the problem. On a more philosophical point, does the majority equal truth? So does the belief that the majority have equal the truth? Well, what does the Quran say in Surah 5, ayah 100? Saying, not equal are the things that are bad and the things that are good, even though the abundance of the bad may dazzle you. So, I'm just from a philosophical perspective, this is, you know, the Quran, I'm not saying that this is an argument just because the text says it. The Quran isn't giving a rational argument. Is it epistemologically sound that just because the majority of people believe in something, that it is true, over a minority? You know, let's take, for example, the belief by scientists. The majority of scientists in the last century, that steady-state theory, the universe, just always has been as it is. Steady-state theory, by the vast majority of scientists, held on to this. Now we love it, but back then, the vast majority of intellectual, academic scientists believed this. You see, so where is that coming from? And of course, and here's a big one for democracy, majority interest will trump minority interest. And the only reason you see that not happening in the West is because liberalism has stepped in and said, no, stop, majority interest, we won't let you, you know, oppress the minorities, I'm sorry. Yeah? And to try to, you know, counteract it, they use positive discrimination to help, you know, equalize the society, a bit of social engineering. This is called ramifications, whereby people think that certain indigenous minorities who are obviously working class, or not the majority of them, but they are working class, they might really believe that, and you know, they're being treated as second-class citizens, and minorities are given first place. And they're rising far right all across Europe, not just in England, all across Europe. And they're more vehement in again countries with proportional representation, with weak government and so on. We can see from Holland, Belgium, France, Germany, and many other countries like that. So I never thought I'd find myself saying, thank God, I live in a country that does not have proportional representation. Although it will catch up at some point, theoretically. So these are issues. What does Islam say about the church? How does Islam protect from the majority dominating the minority? It says, oh, you believe, stand firmly for justice as witnesses to God, even against yourselves. You see, follow not your lust, lest you swerve and you distort justice or decline through justice. Don't follow your desires, follow justice. This is what Islam is saying. And any liberal, I know in theory, liberalism believes that you should follow your desires and not manifest the desires, but a liberal who's moral will say, but if the desires make you do something immoral, then you shouldn't follow the desires, you should follow what is morally correct, is what the Quran is saying. So this is the issues that Islam has with democracy. Islam's very solid on these issues. It doesn't believe that majority makes right. It also has procedural problems and so on with democracy. These procedural problems are that you can't have a system of government based on self-interest. So the ruler is only going to behave because he has a self, he wants to rule, and to be re-elected, he has to basically get your support. But do you want a ruler whose first interest is just to get power? Is that the kind of ruler you want? How can a Muslim kind of live under that system when the Prophet Muhammad often told us that we do not give authority to those who ask for it? So if we're following the, you know, example of the Prophet Muhammad, how can now we vote for someone to vote for me? So why can't? Because you asked for it. You see? And the Prophet Muhammad said that, you know, the end, the last, the final day will not come until all nations are ruled over by the hypocrites. And if you think about it, democracy is a system which benefits the hypocrite more than the principled person. Because if you can tell everyone what they want to hear, you have an advantage over someone who's principled and not everyone agrees with that person. Natural advantage. Simple. And they call it pragmatic compromise, but other people would call it being hypocritical. All things to all men, as they say. You know, so the problem in democracy, minorities will still rule, as in politicians. You have, I mean, why is it that you have the Kennedys and you have the Bushes and you have the Roosevelts? I mean, how is it possible if we all have an equal chance of getting into power that you have within the same family repeated governors and repeated presidents within the same family? How is that possible? It's possible because when in that system, it will benefit those who have more power to influence voting, as in you're more richer, you can get advertisement, you've got business contacts, you can feel corporate interest and so on. There's self-interest and factionism within that system. Again, there are many verses in the Quran, but for the sake of brevity, I'll have to skip those which talk about these issues. So as a Muslim, we can't accept self-interest. You must be in power to serve others, to serve God primarily, and to serve others. Anything else, you shouldn't be in power, and you can't ask for power from anyone. Now, I think I'm going to break past very briefly on liberalism, and I'm going to finish up with the Islamic alternative. Liberalism is a system whereby it's based on the concept that man is inherently good. We are inherently good. So the only thing that makes man bad is he's oppressed. So if you remove the oppression, then man will be inherently good. Who is the most freest person on the face of this planet? The most freest kind of people on the face of this planet? Dictators. They have no limits, no limitations around them, no restrictions, right? So, in theory, these people should be the most pious and most ethical or most moral people on the earth. But they're not. They're the opposite, the direct opposite. Because human beings also, apart from just basic human needs of food, clothing, shelter, we also subject to vanity, greed, and power, which are unlimited impulses, as in you can't satisfy them. They will not be satisfied, and they are perpetually there if you are of that inclination. Lastly, I'll say that how much time I have, sorry?
2 minutes,
okay. But lastly, I'll finish up on Islam. What is the alternative? What is the Islamic alternative? Is it a dictatorship? Well, no. Islam believes that as human beings, we are all the vicegerents of God, but we can't all manage our collective affairs. We can't manage resources, we can't, you know, look in a collective way. How do we know what's best for the group? What Islam believes is that we all, to discharge our obligation to God, to establish a just system, we get together and select one from amongst us who will implement the system. This person is accountable and their power is limited and is conditional. If the Prophet Muhammad said that you obey your leader as long as he obeys God. So if the leader does not obey God, then you must deal with him. From ranging from telling him to leave to rising up against him. And this is why you could say that in Muslim countries, the dictators are very very sternly against people, because Islam, they know that Islam is telling the people to rise up against them, and that's why they're very stern with the people, and they're very oppressive. So the Islamic system gives an accountable government with a judiciary, which will count the leader. Everyone is under the law. No one is above the law. No one can own Islam. The leader is accountable for what he does, and he cannot choose to make any laws he wants. He has to implement the Sharia. He has no choice in it. He's just an executive, if you want to think about it. And you could say God is the sovereign. And anyone can participate in the rebel politics. You have a multi-party system whereby different groups of Muslims or non-Muslims or whoever go out and account the leader and tell the people about what's happening on in the realm of politics. As the Quran says, that they arise from amongst you, ummatun, plural, multiple groups, which call to the good and forbid the evil. So as Muslims, we believe that we are politically involved and engaged with the system. And of course, the ruler, in discharging the affairs mandated by Islam of justice and distribution of wealth and protection of property and life, has to consult the people on policies. So, for example, should he invest money into healthcare or into education? Ask the people. What do they think they want more? That's shura, consultation. If it requires an expert, then the expert is marshaled up to consult the expert to implement the policy. So about greenhouse emissions, you have to consult scientists. You can't consult some guy on the street. So Islam has this engagement with the people, where the people are actively involved in accounting, selecting, and maintaining their government system. It is not democracy because it is a system whereby the people, the majority rule, doesn't have will out. People are not sovereign. The law is sovereign. However, the people are, have confidence that the system will provide what they need, no matter who is in power. And inshallah, if you want to ask a question a bit more about how that works in the question and answer session, I'll be happy to answer questions. But thank you for listening, and I hope you find it enjoyable.
Some themes that came out there that bounced off each other, some ideas that were similar, some ideas that were very, very different. I mean, we've got on the one side an empirical study of what groups of male Muslims were saying in America and England, and then on the other side you've got a committed Muslim activist putting a point of view that represents the community. What we're going to do now is we're going to take some questions. I'd like you, when you put your hand up and you're selected, to tell me your name and your subject area, only because it might be useful for us to see how subjects feed into a discussion like this. So it's open to anyone. Can you make it clear whether you're wanting to address both speakers or just one speaker so that we can be clear? Questions? We have about 20 minutes. Yeah?
I'm not a student, but can I ask a question?
You can ask a question if you...
My special study was theology when I was a student.
Right.
To Abdullah, do you think the Western governments, Western powers will allow the kind of Islamic society we speak of to arise, say, in the Middle East or elsewhere? Do you think that what we in the West as respected the democracy and self-determination will allow that to happen? Real
sure. You know what's very interesting about these quote unquote Arab revolutions? I don't know what they mean, the Arabs though, because the Muslim revolutions, I prefer to call it, is that the kind of response we got across the board from media in the West, from the neocons, from also militant atheists, and so on. And what they said about Tunisia, Egypt, and so on is that the guy might have been a bad guy, but at least he was on our side. You know, who knows what the people of Tunisia or Egypt might conjure up from their, you know, from their own minds and from their own aspirations. At least we knew what we could expect, and at least he was pro-American or pro-UK. It's very interesting now that you hear this across the board, almost. You know, and this is very interesting. You know, Christopher Hitchens in 2007 praising Tunisia as the model secular state for the Middle East and so on, even though everyone hated it in Tunisia. And it was a repressive religion, which perhaps reflects more on Christians' religions than anything else. But this is the issue, that if the Muslim world could decide their own political future, then this future might not be as profitable as the current status quo in the Middle East for corporations, for foreign interests, and so on. And so, obviously, Israel itself will be obviously threatened by these of interest, so Israel itself has a stake to keep in place dictators and tyrants. So what we're seeing is that people are choosing realpolitik and materialism over moral kind of, you know, consideration. And there's a reason for this. Because according to liberal theory, you can't have autonomy without your basic human needs being satisfied, which comes from material or wealth and so on. So in order to facilitate freedom, you need material kind of realistic aspect, which comes in the form of capitalism. Now, there is, I would say that the West is in two minds, where you have people of good conscience against materialistic foreign policies in the Middle East, and those of neocons and other people who are for materialistic foreign policies in the Middle East. And there's like a schizophrenia happening in the West on these two issues, and this current crisis in the Middle East has shown this, has exposed this. And I think that's actually quite interesting. And this is the problem that we need to address as Muslims. We have to strive past both the domestic and international interests in Muslim countries, and to try to create a system that truly represents our deepest aspirations, which is Islam. Even if we use the word democracy, I bet you if you ask any of these Muslims, as Amadeh also asked, what you mean by this? It didn't mean that people are sovereign. It didn't mean that people can believe in that any impulse they should be allowed to enact. It meant that people have the freedom to choose which leader they have, because they don't have this freedom to choose which leader they have now. And in Islam, we believe that you can choose, you have the freedom to choose which leader you are under. So this is what people mean by democracy. As I said, as George Orwell said, democracy means different things to different people.
Okay. I've got a question. If you don't mind, do you mind if I ask a question? Which is, I was interested, both of you in your own ways talked about democracy as a technology, more like a technology of doing things. And I'm very conscious that in the present unrest that we have in a number of countries, the whole kind of social networking, the IT communications are moving at such speed that it's creating movements that have never been seen before in terms of speed, etc. And I'm just wondering if that will have implications for democracy.
Definitely. But none of us can say what will happen in the next 6 months, or Tunisia, or of course Yemen, or Bahrain, or Syria. It could all go frightfully wrong, and you could end up with another dictator. Now, of course, you would say some dictators are good, but I would say I'd rather not. I'd rather have a democracy, even though it's imperfect. Of course, that democracy is imperfect. I think you say that a leader should be trusted by the people once he's been chosen. And he will consult. Now, if that works perfectly, it's a good form of government. But it may be that in practice, democracy, though imperfect, keeps the government closer to the wishes of the people. Then you might say that the wishes of the people are not what the government should follow anyhow. I'm not quite so sure what you'd say about that.
So the technology and the
implications. Well, it's just giving us a new way to coordinate our insurrections against these dictators. I'm not for any dictatorship of any kind. I don't want no human being subjecting me to their vanity, nor a minority or a majority in either kind of sense. What I do believe, as I said, that the concept of caliph in Islam is not a person which, oh, we just trust what he says. He says he's going to be doing this for X, Y, Z reason, we just trust what he says. No. But rather, we know that on a day-to-day basis, the leader obviously will be delivering healthcare, and there's a civil service in place which is doing work, which happened in the summer civilization, which as everyone else does. However, we always scrutinize the leader. And I'll give you an example. The Prophet Muhammad's companion, Omar, when he was the caliph, after a battle with a foreign power, he came back, and from the spoils of the enemy army, there were some garments. And the garment was distributed once every person who participated in the battle, as it's a egalitarian division of spoils from the enemy army's camp. And he was wearing two garments when he was giving a sermon. He was wearing two garments. So one guy got up right in front of him in the middle of his sermon and said, "I hear you, but we do not obey you." And it's almost like, why don't you obey me? What's wrong? And it's like, all of us were given one garment at the end of that battle. However, you have two garments after that battle. You know, this is injustice. So Omar said that this is the second garment, it's my son's garment. And then he had to call his son to come all the way from his house to come to see Omar and say, yeah, that's actually my one, lent it to him. It's the second garment. So that in our system, the caliph was accountable for literally the shirt is back. And this is the system, accountability. Because the Prophet Muhammad said, and all the caliphs, especially the first four ones, said that if you witness the ruler doing something outside of Islam, there is no hearing and obeying of this person. If you see this, you don't hear and obey this person. And you count them, and there is, I can quote so many narrations where the Prophet Muhammad said that you must tie down the tyrant, the oppressor, and bind the oppressor, and limit the oppressor to the truth, limit the oppressor to only doing what is just. And in many hadiths, using force is necessary. So we have a very active role against the government. You must use, you know, protest, demonstration, sometimes even violence against the leader, to make sure the leader does not veer from the desires of the people. And of course, there is conditions. Obviously, if you're not having a particular policy because you're a doctor and healthcare got cut for education, the money is for education, well, you can't rise up, but you can demonstrate whatever lobby. However, if the leader is taking money from the treasury for his own pocket, like what happened in the Middle East, or subjecting the natural resources of the state to foreign exploitation at a much cheaper price than is reasonable for any other state that has natural resources, then you must deal with this caliph. First, by speaking to him. Second, by going to scholars and or getting the courts to invite him. And if he has control of even the courts by some method, then you uprise against this leader and evict him from power. This is the Islamic method for counting the courts.
There's two people here. So,
Thanks to both of the speakers. I don't have a question. I've got criticism. Are we allowed to do that? Okay. My criticism.
So, just staff. Are you a student or
a member of staff?
Member of staff. Okay.
To your first speaker, I'll say my criticism to your first speaker first. It's mine. I reserve my amazing I think there was only one element in your talk which I want to highlight, which is you refer to the rules in the Quran as being punishments in the hereafter, and there are no rules in this world. Okay. I'm not sure that's exactly what you meant, but no, there's just a matter of rules about this world. I was in a House of Lords committee meeting yesterday, and we were mainly talking about monetary policy and the problems of the existing financial system, and there were lots of scholars there, Muslims and non-Muslims, who proposed quite different systems. There are very clear rules about transactions, particularly financial transactions in Islam. There is an Islamic government who have these rules in Islam. So it's not, the punishments aren't all in here. I wanted them up, okay? But in Islam, they are related to this world. My criticism to your second speaker is his criticism of majority rule. It's way important. I want to ask him some questions to make him realize the errors in his way. Okay? But first of all, as Sawad al-Azam, majority rule is a principle in Islam. And it's a principle at many, many different levels, government and others. Okay? I want to ask you, we have three principal sources of Islam. Tell us, 1, 2, and 3. Okay, what's the first one?
You don't know
them? No, I know them. I want you to tell me. What's the third one?
One of you tell us all.
Okay, what's the first one?
There are four sources of Islam.
First one?
There's Quran.
Thank you.
Sunnah. Right? Some say consensus of the companions.
Is it majority companion or consensus companion?
Ijma. Okay. Well, it doesn't really matter whether it's consensus. No, it does, because if one companion disagrees, then it is not consensus and it's not binding.
Okay. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's 100% or 50% or more. Ijma is considered a primary, it's a principle in Islam. When you have to come to a decision, and you've got the freedom to make that decision, we're not talking about decisions are already made by revelation. Okay. We're talking about the read, where you can make a decision, where a government can make a decision. Okay. It is the majority that will have to go. It's the majority decision that will be accepted. The minority decision is not accepted. Only when there is no revelation related to this matter. So it's not possible for Muslims to meet and decide we're going to pray twice every day instead of five times a day. We know this. Okay? Because that is already a decision that's already been made by revelation, we have no choice about it. Okay? But where you've got most decisions the government have nothing to do with, whether you pray, whether you're praying, whether you're fast, and so on. Okay? Government decisions are done by by Ismail, by Ijma'. Okay. Whether it's 100% or 50% or more, Ijma' is central. It's not the minority. Okay. And there are several hadiths of the Prophet in which he says that the decision of the emir or the president or the head of state, okay, is not immune. He can make an error, but the jama'ah, the group, cannot make.
Yeah, all right. Thank you. To qualify with your statements, okay. Basically, if you look at what Islam is also saying, consensus means that we all agree, all of us agree, ijma, agreement, full agreement. It's not majority or minority. And where does it actually occur is actually in how you implement as opposed to what you implement. So it says discharge your affairs by mutual obligation, not decide your affairs by mutual obligation. Every time that the Prophet Muhammad used the word affairs, he referred to Islam and Islamic injunctions. He said, your affairs, this affair. He said, Islamic injunctions. So now, saying that, well, things which have been decided by the revelation, that's fine, but things which haven't been, we can decide. Well, you have to qualify this because it's like me saying that, let's say interest, yeah? Interest. Interest is not the exact same concept of that the Muslims encounter with river, but using analogy, analogical reasoning, they deduced that interest was usury, the river. They deduced this, even though the exact word is not there, right? Now, every issue, there are principles in Islam, it's not mentioned explicitly, there are principles in Islam that can address these issues. So you now need to extrapolate the injunction from Islam to these issues. You map it on. But where the shura come into it is in things like, okay, well then, I'll give you one example. The Prophet Muhammad in Medina was surrounded by these pagan Meccans who were at war with him. They were about to approach Medina and trying to attack. So one person said, let's face them outside the town, and because we can't let them come to our houses, so to speak, because that looks really bad. But then, that we have attacked them outside, and they're going to let them come into our territory. I guess. And another person said, well, let's let them come here and under siege, because we've never been defeated while on the siege. We've never ever been defeated. Both are two sound military, strategies. Totally sound. So what the Prophet did when there's an equal weighting to these two sound military stratagems, he says, okay, what are you guys going to do? So people said, no, let's fight. And then some people still said, the minority still said, let's stay here. So he said, okay, it's not befitting a prophet to take off his armor once he's put it back on, because he's thinking he's going to go out to meet them and fight. And then they fought the battle of Uhud, which, funnily enough, they lost. But the majority was the issue was fine. If the people want in this situation which has equal weighting, what do you have more confidence in doing that we all do together?
No, I find it's not a problem.
Okay. But it's not a truth. It's not an issue about judging.
I'm going to take another question now, if you don't mind. And we've got about 5 or 10 minutes, so people that want to ask a question, do let me know. So,
my question is a bit more of a philosophical question, I suppose.
Right.
Just hypothetically, if God came into your house where your family was sitting there and said, follow me in my law, would you first have to consult your family before you go back? I reach a majority decision as well.
Okay, that's a good one. Who's going to start? Did you take that one?
Well, I think if God came into my house, I'd leave him to convince the others that he was right.
Did you want to say anything more about the relationship between the sort of religious value and collectivism?
I think religion is a private matter, and each person has his own attitude. And so I think the Muslim has an attitude, but I don't criticize it or necessarily support it any more than I criticize or support the attitude of a member of the Church of England, which I haven't gone to. I think that nowadays religion is a private matter. I must say that's my conclusion.
Okay.
That's a good question. Well, I really made my choice. I didn't even see God. So, but what I'll say is this. I think just to, I guess, explain. I think what my friend was trying to say. The truth is not decided by majorities and minorities. You decide it based on your conscience. If you basically think science is true, then you go into it. And as the Quran says, perhaps I'm just a warner, and if those want to accept it, if those want to reject my message, reject it. So in this situation, we have to decide using our consciences. The majority can, and most times is, wrong. In Europe right now, you're seeing what's happening with the majority all backing Sarkozy, all backing in Belgium, and Go Borders is becoming ever more popular. So you're seeing now, I'm not just now completely blowing out proportion, I'm seeing the situation. And in America, the constitution is creaking at trying to repress the mass hysteria, which is now trying to alienate one of its minorities. And remember, Europe has had a history, despite being democratic, of persecuting or repressing or discriminating against minorities. The Jews were before the Muslims. And funny enough, we have the Jews and Muslims have a very similar kind of law system and with almost identical practices on many levels. So this is the issue that we're trying to see. When people say to us, how can we guarantee minority rights in a Muslim country for Christians? And I say, don't worry, we're not democratic. So, we'll protect their rights no matter what. Even if the majority hate them or what have you. And this is the case. I'm not trying to just launch an invective against democracy. But this is not even the Muslim contention. It's not even my contention or the Quran's contention. This is, across the board, I can quote you a litany of Enlightenment philosophers from the West. So many, and pre-Enlightenment philosophers, and even contemporary philosophers, who all agree. And even lecturers at this university that would probably agree. Maybe they could be the next lecture and discuss the issue of democracy.
Well, I'll take one more question.
If
there's no others, I'll
let you.
Oh, yes,
Kevin. Just a few more enlightened philosophers, just the thread that sort of kept coming back to me, and I heard both of you speak, was the way in which enlightened philosophy, leaning into liberalism, as you both brilliantly outlined, and to some extent, some of the Islamic traditions that we're hearing about tonight, in a sense are quite similar to one another, maybe, over against what I want to throw into the melting pot as a third way. And that is a way in which, with a kind of nuanced mediation sense. So, for example, in the Enlightenment liberal area, there are constant divorces and dualities that are set up between, for example, you hinted a little bit at it just by saying private public, that we're now in a world where religious belief should remain private, whereas other things are more public. The divorce between the sciences and the arts and the way our libraries are set up, the division between facts and values, between the subjective and the objective, and so on. This is really where any notion of God in the Enlightenment becomes replaced by another supreme authority, the timeless truths of human reason, which are actually no less imperialistic. They just come from a kind of 17th, 18th century Western European idea of what human reason ought to be. But that human reason dictated that the world should be divided into two, the messy, contingent world of history and the pure world of faith, or the kind of day-to-day world of the particular and the realm of the universal, where truth is to be discovered. That is an Enlightenment liberal duality, which, for example, has nothing to do with Christianity whatsoever. On the other side, we have an Islamic view put by you, Abdullah, where there is a kind of very strong concern that if the majority decision is followed, and I know Yasser was picking up on a challenge, if the majority is followed, oh goodness me, we're into a state of relativism where truth is just what the majority believe. And you're quite, I think, quite right to worry about that.
majority rule does not necessarily mean that that's true. How many people have to believe something for it to be true? No one may believe it. It's still true, right? So truth is coming from a divine source, through revelation, or somewhere other than simply majority rule. But that concern about contingent, messy, day-to-day world politics and human history, throwing up a majority rule which has got it wrong, if you like, I see as a similar, I put that in a sense, as a similar bracket to the duality of the Enlightenment, which also splits a realm of timeless truth here from contingent history and politics down there. And I'm not trying to say necessarily that there's a huge overlap in that, but there's a certain commonality to which I would want to say there's a third way to look at that, which is where truth in a vertical sense, through faith communities, so believing that there's some authority beyond the here and now, truth in that way can be discovered and mediated in the existential here and now in the messy world of day-to-day politics. And that's quite a kind of nuanced view which I'd like to share, which I think mainly challenges Islam to some extent in the way you put it, but also certainly challenges so-called liberalism in a post-Enlightenment way. I put that there to see if you have any thoughts on it.
Well, my thought is that that most politics is not to do with truth and untruth and great things like that at all, but as to the level of income tax or the cost of this or the cost of that. And those sort of things are eminently decided by majorities, so long, of course, as the minority's interests are kept in mind many things by having coalition. In the case of Britain and America, by having an in and out certain minorities and majority next time. And they're not really dealing with truths at all. They're dealing with ordinary back-end affairs.
But that itself is an enlightenment distinction. So you've taken it by truth, I mean something abstract, something philosophical, whereas the pragmatic decisions are not about truth.
Yes.
That's not a distinction.
Which, 2 minutes, and I'm going to stop because I know some people have got to go and some people are going, so I would like to sort of round this up in a formal way, so I'll just leave you to have a quick, now that very deep...
I'll be very brief. As you said, you're probably more closer, that concept is more closer to the Islamic Orthodox conception, one last point here, then what the gentleman over there with and so on. And what I say is this, in Islam, we acknowledge that there are Christians and Jews and other groups that don't believe what we believe. But we don't have a concept of one law for all. So it's Sharia and you must abide by this. No. A Christian doesn't believe in Sharia. Why should you enforce it on a Christian? Why should you enforce it on a Jew? It's not their law. They don't believe in it. How can I enfranchise them in a system that's not their law? Fine, Sharia does not distinguish, so it will give the human rights to everyone, food, clothing, shelter, protection of property, and so on, healthcare, education, to everybody, all human beings. However, the Christian should not be under Sharia law, that if they want to eat pork, fine, they should eat pork. A Jew, I'm trying to find a difference between a Jew and a Muslim in terms of our laws, we're very similar, and so on, but shellfish, then if they want to avoid shellfish, that's fine, you don't want to force it. So, that's totally fine. And what you saw was the Islamic multicultural system was that it had areas, it had its own civil courts for Christians, own civil courts for Jews, for many areas of their own law systems. And that was understood. And all they had to do, they were only enfranchising the state as contract citizens. But the Rousseauian contract citizen, whereby essentially you pay tax and the state provides you with security and basic services. And in Islam, the word for contract citizen is a dhimmi. It's a dhimma contract. Dhimmi means protect citizen. Whereas for a Muslim, you have a religious obligation to the state, which a Christian Jew does not have. And so our theological religious obligation, we have to pay now a zakat tax to the state, which is discharging one of our kind of religious obligations. And we have to fight to defend that state, whether we are paying, or not, we like it or not. We have to fight and defend non-Muslims and whoever. This is our religious obligation invested in that state, which the Jew and Christian doesn't have to do. They don't have to join the army or anything. They can just be protected and live their lives. So this is the difference, and I think maybe that's similar to what you were saying, and you won't get this in a democracy, because in every system of democracy I've ever encountered, it has been one law for all, and that's called people to infight. You have Kenya, you have Thailand, you have Rwanda, you have so many other countries whereby different groups of people fought each other because there's been a fight between factions, whereas Islam is like, fine, you're a different group, you have different interests, those interests should be catered for you in your areas. And this is how Islam brings different people together without imposing on anyone.
What I would like to say is I think first of all, you've been a superb audience. Thank you for listening. It is the first time we've done an webinar, certainly since I can remember. And I want to thank both our speakers very, very much for what has been really quite deep, quite interesting, two different ways of viewing things, but actually with lots of parallel themes. And I hope that this will be one of many. So I'd just like you to clap once more for the two speakers.